Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
An Erio's original.
So what she proceeds to tell me changed my life. She says, I don't know if you want to do this, but I see you writing for TV.
I love those layers. There's so many layers to the onion. We used to say any story in the onion is going to be 5 times funnier than any story in any other publication, even if it's not as funny.
It's taking over my dreams, waking me out of my sleep. I think I'm coming apart.
Hi, this is Margaret Cho. You're listening to The Margaret Cho. Welcome, our guest today, Leslie Arfin, with an amazing tale of psychics.
Yeah, I'm coming out of the dark.
Oh. Jafan.
Thank you. That's
and
so
I
nice.
Have been for a really long time.
You're
and my
amazing.
Best friend, who is now passed, but his name was Bencho, and we were obsessed with you, and he was always like, I think we're related, and I was like, you definitely are.
I love that.
Yeah, and so that's I really
awesome.
Appreciate you
thank
having
you.
Me.
Thank you.
A mere pedestrian.
No.
On your podcast.
No.
Well, it's fine. I feel like, you know, very okay with being a worker among workers.
It is good.
You know what I mean?
It's good. I mean, we all are.
Yeah.
We all are. I mean, I think it's like, to me, I really respect what you do because I have no patience to sit there and write. Ugh, I hate it.
Me too.
It's hard.
It's the hardest
thing. But you do it in such a great way.
It's not graceful. I mean, like, I do it because I can't not do it.
Yeah.
But it's really hard and it's not fun. And I don't know why anybody would choose. I'm going to be a writer. It's like, don't make that choice for yourself.
How did you start?
Well, I started, and I was going to say this ties into the story that I really wanted to tell you.
Okay.
Which is my psychic story.
Yeah.
But I started writing for Vice magazine when I got out of college. So I majored, I went to Hampshire. I knew I wanted to do creative writing at college. Mm-hmm. And I started interning at Vice when I graduated from college. And at the time, Vice was, there were 6 people who worked there.
Mm-hmm.
There was one other woman. She was the office manager. And I would read the articles in Vice, and they were some female writers. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't know I could write stuff like this.
Yeah.
Like The Vice Guide to Eating Pussy. And
yeah.
It was by Christy Bradnox. And I was like, that's what I want to write. Like,
yeah.
I know where I want to work. I know what I want to do. And I went and I found out that it was a fake name and Gavin McInnes had written it and he had just used fake names to see. So it seemed like Vice had more writers.
Oh, uh-huh.
That they were like a very large staff.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They had one female writer who wrote a column in Canada and that was it. And so I was like, hey, can I review this album and can I do this? And I just would ask. And then they were like, yeah, give it a go. They needed writers who would work for nothing.
Right.
And so, and then I took over that Canadian writer's column, mm-hmm. Dear Diary.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote that. We made it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked Lena if I could write on her show Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an agent because of the book.
Yeah.
And this ties into my psychic story, which we'll get to, but I didn't know TV writing was like a thing I could do.
Yeah.
Like I thought it was like Harvard guys
Yeah, and of course.
That's it. Like, all I had ever heard was like The Simpsons and Conan. It's like Harvard guys.
Right.
And I just didn't, it never occurred to me. Like, I didn't study film or TV or communications even. Like, I went to like a hippie school in Massachusetts and I did poetry and like short story writing, which was like who's writing short story? I mean, like people write short stories, but like it's not, I wasn't very good at it and it wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
Writing for funny was for me. I just didn't know it was a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how I started making money as a writer. But while I worked at Vice, I also worked 1,000 other jobs. I lived in New York. I'm from New York.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at a hotel for many years. Mm-hmm. I worked retail all over and then worked the door at clubs and coat check and what, I mean, I think I'm trying to think of what else, because I did so many, I DJ'd.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
It was like in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Like anybody can DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would do that. So I worked like 1,000 jobs and wrote at Vice until I moved here to write for Girls and joined a union and like started paying taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how it all happened.
And Girls was such a genius show.
I know. It was really fun and unlike any other writer's room I've ever been in still. And
yeah. It really changed, I think, the perspective of writing for young women and actually gave it so much gravity, which it never had before.
I totally agree.
You know?
And Lena was so brave.
Yeah.
And honest and like...
Just great. So
and
great.
And funny. And it was fun to do it with her because it was her show, but she had never worked on a TV show either.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, it never felt, and she was doing it with Jenny Connor, but I never felt like, I can't do this. I don't have a voice here. I'm too green for this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just very open.
Yeah.
Which was
really important because then it was like free to be anything.
Totally.
You know, and that's what made it so, I think, profound, because it was like this doesn't have to be like Gossip Girl or,
right,
you know, anything that we've seen of girls on television. This is like really new, but also so much like it was like a heart opening, like I just got it.
Totally.
In a deep way.
And it was such a big deal
mm-hmm.
for her to be 24
mm-hmm.
and have a show on HBO.
Yeah.
It was like, I mean, like there's a lot of TV shows. It's just it's bigger, everybody has their own show, kind, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
different. But yeah. at the time I was like, my friend called me and she was like, you're gonna write, Lena Dunham's doing a show on HBO with Judd Apatow, you're gonna write on it.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how I'm gonna do that. She's like, I'm gonna tell you.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, you're gonna write a spec script. What's that?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know. She was like, 30 pages, make it have a beginning, middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to be funny. Just be yourself. Tell a story.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I can do that. Can you loan me the money to get Final Draft?
Yeah.
But yeah, Nicole, this is my friend Nicole Beatty, who's a writer still. And she was like, I wrote on Deadwood and I got kicked out of University of Arizona. Like, you don't have to be a Harvard dude to do this.
Right.
I'm going to tell you how to do it.
Yeah.
And like,
that's great.
Which was awesome. Yeah.
That's really great, because it's like the fear of not being a Harvard guy can keep you out of these things, you know? Like, just the fear of like not knowing what to do. So somebody telling you is really, that's really great.
It was awesome. And like, it was still like, it was, I guess it was like 10 years ago. So it was not that long ago. But that's when I started writing for Girls, but like the stuff that came before that, and when I was around like late 20s, early 30s, and maybe I was just like a little scared, a little bit in denial, didn't have as much confidence, didn't have my ear to the streets as much, but I just didn't think these things weren't even options for me because I just didn't think that I was allowed. Like and I was still waiting for permission to be smart enough or like funny enough. And it's like, whatever, just try it and fail.
Yeah.
And like, worst thing that happens is that you fuck up and then you get back up again. I mean, not to quote like the Trolls soundtrack. I also have a kid now, so it's like my references are like really bad.
No, it's good. No, but it's good though. It is good. It's like, just do it. Like, we don't need permission.
Yeah.
We've been waiting for permission for so long, and like, we just don't need it.
And like, I would hear people say that. Like, I would hear you say that in your stand up, but I just didn't think it applied to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I still was like, well, I'm not old enough. I'm not rich enough. I'm not in LA. I'm just, you know, it. And that's like the lie. That's on me.
Yeah.
Like, that's not anybody's fault. There is nobody to blame. No, but like, I was still like in the Lower East Side and Brooklyn, you know, up in the scene. Like, there are girls who are, and women who are my age, who like all over the country, who certainly didn't think it was available to them or it was an option. Like, much bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my confidence and my low self-esteem was really like a block for me.
Yeah.
And like, still is. Like, I'm not immune to it. You know,
we always, that's the biggest thing that we come up against, is our own critic and our own like imposter syndrome, which grows up alongside our creative self, that is like there to stifle the creative self. You know, it's like the the bad twin that constantly tries to silence you because it's like the only thing they can. And it's really, that's your main opponent, is your own self-doubt.
Would you say that's like our super ego?
And it's our shadow side,
right?
And it's this, and it's actually the stuff that in the interior of that shadow side makes our writing interesting and relatable and dark and nasty. But we have to get through that opponent to be able to share that. So it's a very, it's a weird creative journey, you know, because it's like when you're trying to create stuff and you have like this thing that's trying to stifle you while you're doing it, it's really hard because we're strong.
Yeah.
We can shut ourselves down easily.
It's just so bewildering to me how strong that voice is.
Because it's as strong as we are, but it's like, you know, it's just there. It's always easy to contain things than let them out. You know, it's weird how that is.
It's like easier until it's not, is the thing. And that is why I think I can't not write.
Yeah.
It's because I get to a point where the easier thing to do is for me to let it out.
Yeah.
It's just too hard. Great. I mean, thank God.
That's really great.
Totally.
That's lucky, you know, because there's so many people. Like, it's weird, like, as I've grown up in around comedy and learned so much and met so many people, there are so many people that are so brilliant, but they just can't let anything out, you know, because their inner critic is too harsh. It's like their like inner shadow side is too much of the darkness, won't allow the light in. It's sad. So you see all this brilliance around just die.
Totally.
Within that artist, or you just don't see it again. And it's really, it's the people who just work on letting it out that really succeed.
So I really have always wanted to tell this story on a podcast, and I have a podcast, but my podcast is about me talking to other people, not so much about me. And I didn't. So again, I'm really grateful that you had me on.
I'm glad.
I just think it's like, it's a cool story. It's one of my, if not the only, as a writer, it's sad to say this, but it's like the only story that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or at least like the only really good one. And that, do you believe in psychics? Like, what's your stance on, do you talk to a psychic regularly?
Not regularly, but I have had really amazing experiences with different ones over time. I think it's like, I'm not sure about all of the ones that I've met, but some of them have been really perceptive.
Well, I've always been, my whole life, really, really interested in the occult and psychics and things of unknown origin.
Yeah.
And I just had never had a good psychic experience. And I had a handful at this time. And I was around in my late 20s. And like, I'd had a handful and they just weren't, I could just feel it. It just wasn't, it was never right. And I was always like, I really like believe in this thing, but I've never had a good reading. And I was always open-minded, and I felt like I didn't not believe in it. It just at this time it wasn't on the forefront of my mind.
Yeah.
I'd had some experiences, they weren't good, and my mom had gotten a psychic medium as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
She's a social worker, and it was her birthday, and her mother had passed.
Mm-hmm.
My grandma died a while ago, but my mom was really close with her, and she got this gift to talk to this really talented medium. And my mom didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't for her. She just didn't want this woman to say anything that she felt like wasn't true about mm-hmm. my grandmother, whom she had a very specific and close relationship with. She was like, I'd rather like not know.
Yeah.
So at the time I'm in Sweden and mm-hmm. I was there for a copywriting job. It was like one of my freelancy jobs for a vodka company. Mm-hmm. And I was about to board the plane. I was there for a week and I got a stomach virus and I had to stay overnight at the airport, at the Radisson. It was like, Swedish Radisson, super nice.
Yeah.
Very clean. But I was miserable. It was an awful, awful stomach virus. And I was so homesick and regular sick and so lonely that I called my sister, who I'm not a phone person in general. And mm-hmm. I definitely am not good at calling my family.
Mm-hmm.
But I just needed to talk to somebody at the time. And I called her. I didn't know the time difference. I was so sick. I was like, just talk. Mm-hmm. I just need to hear like a voice of love and comfort right now mm-hmm. while I writhe around in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, all right, like, what do you want me to talk about? I was like, anything. Just like, tell me what you did today, whatever. And she's like, well, I talked to a psychic the other day, and which is very not my sister.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Why? Oh, mom had it as a gift. She didn't want it. Anyway, I said, how did it go? And she was like, it was not good. She only talked about you.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, totally like better all of a sudden.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Me? And tell me more. I'm like, what did she say about me? And she was like, my sister, like, this is going to sound like really weird and stupid, but do you have like a fake drink that they make for you at like a bar you go to? And I was like, be more specific. You know, she's like, I don't know. She said that there's a bar that you go to a lot and they make a special fake drink that has a name just for you. She's like, it's so dumb. And I was like, well, yeah, I live across the street from Max Fish. All my friends bartend there and they make me a watertini, mm-hmm. which is water in a martini glass. Cause I, at the time I'd been sober for like 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, well, you mean a watertini? And she was like, what? That's a thing? What are you talking about? You said, I was like, well, they make me a watertini at Max Fish. And she was like, shut the fuck up.
Because mm-hmm.
she said it was like a water fake name. Maybe she had even said the name and I'm not remembering. She was like, it was a water something.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, you're saying that's real? Mm-hmm. And at the time, there was only Facebook.
Yeah.
I had not written about this.
Mm-hmm.
There was no Instagram, Twitter. This wasn't public information. It was like a very like weird insider.
Yeah.
Not even important.
Yeah.
And she was just like, holy shit. I cannot believe that that's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, all right, give me the number of this psychic. Mm-hmm. Give me her email. I want to make an appointment. So I sent her an email. I told her who I was. The sister of a woman who you just spoke to recently. My email was like Leslie Orphan at Hotmail or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I made an appointment. It was $150 and it was only on the phone, not in person. She only did it on the phone. I think it's an hour session. It was at the time an hour session for $150. At the time I was living by myself in the Lower East Side, in the midst of breaking up with my boyfriend, who was a white rapper named Machine.
Mm-hmm.
It was not going well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing freelance copywriting, which was, you know, come and go. Sometimes it would be really great and good money and sometimes not. Just didn't really know what was happening with my life. Worked retail, whatever. So I get on the phone with this woman And I barely said anything the whole time. She's just in it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, "You're sober." And I was like, "Mm-hmm." You know, she's like, "You don't have to answer. I'm just going to tell you."
Mm-hmm.
She named my sobriety date. Mm-hmm. And then she said, "Do you have a grandparent whose name starts with A?" And I said, "Well, yeah, both my grandparents were Al and Alice, mm-hmm. orphan." Great. So I'm in, mm-hmm. right? But I'm still, because I haven't had good experiences, I'm taking it with like, I'm just taking everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
Like I want it to be, I want to figure out, like, she knew about the water teeny and mm-hmm. like, just want to stay open and not judgmental either way.
Yeah.
So what she proceeds to tell me changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, "The guy you're with right now, you're in the middle of breaking up with him." She said he's a musician in entertainment. She wasn't specific like that. She wasn't like, "He's a white rapper."
Mm-hmm.
She's like, "This is not the man for you. This is not the person who you're supposed to be with. It wasn't a waste of time. It just, I'm sensing that you want to get married and have a family, but this isn't the guy, and you're going to go out with another guy, but he's not going to be the guy either."
Mm-hmm.
"But it's really important for you to have that relationship because the guy after is going to be the guy that you marry."
Mm.
And I said, "Okay." She said, "The guy who you go out with after this one right now, it will be a long distance relationship, but..." She was like, "Just stay open. Like, it might seem at times like, am I on the right path? Am I on the right path? Questioning it, don't question it, go with it."
Mm.
"Just follow it." She's like, "If you see signs, like your favorite number, you have a lucky number, you have a lucky animal who you see all the time, a symbol, take that as a sign of I'm on the right path," which I do. Mm. I have a lucky number that I see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, "Great."
Yeah.
She's like, "Don't tell me what it is, whatever." She says, "You're a TV writer?" And I said, "No, I'm just a writer."
Because,
mm-hmm. like I said, I had, at that point, it wasn't an option. Mm-hmm. I thought it was Harvard guys in the Simpsons room.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Oh, well, you're going to, I don't know if you want to do this, but I see you writing for TV."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Cool." I thought she meant like in 20 years one day, like whatever. She goes, "HBO. Specifically HBO. Wow. I said, "Wow, sounds mm-hmm. great.
Yeah.
Love it." She's like, "Yeah, I see you really doing well in that area. And you're going to move to LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, at this point, I had been to LA, I think, 3 times in my
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
4. Again, cool. Sounds great. Near distant future. Whatever. Like, I was recording it and I was writing stuff down, but it all sounded great
mm-hmm.
for a life that I had never, that was somebody else's.
Yeah.
And like, sure, maybe, but mm-hmm. whatever. She's like, "Yeah, so you're going to go back and forth between New York and LA for a year until you're eventually going to move there
mm-hmm.
and you'll move and live and work and get married and have a family in Los Angeles."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she told me, so I was like, great. She told me a lot of other things about my family, some trauma that had been there with me and my parents, and stuff that, you know, was right to me, but also nothing that I had ever shared or want to share right now. But there was like a level of, she was like, "You had another grandparent, not the one that starts with the letter A, who really loved you. I mean, that's my other grandfather. I was his mm-hmm. favorite," you know, stuff like that. And then she said, we were talking for a while, all that career stuff. And she said, "You know, you're psychic.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?" And I was like, I never mm-hmm. said that to anybody, but I did kind of know it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, kind of. And mm-hmm. she was like, "Yeah." She's like, you're psychic. If you want to strengthen that sense, mm-hmm. you know, read this book.
Mm.
It's called You Are Psychic. She's like, I know it's like a dumb title, but uh-huh. pretty kind of on the nose title. But she's like, you can work on those skills if you want to strengthen it. But like, you have some, I see something in you that's the same as me, and it's that. Mm. And I was like, you know, I was feeling that.
Yeah.
And I liked hearing that.
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, you totally know you have it and you don't, and you, and I see it. And she's like, don't feel weird about it. And you don't have to tell people, but like, know that you know. It's cool. Like, you work on it and whatever. And I was like, I don't know. It felt good to kind of be validated for something I had never asked for.
Yeah.
Because I did kind of always know that, but it's like a weird thing.
Yeah,
like,
it's weird. It's weird to admit that.
And then we were talking for a little bit longer, and I'll preface by saying that as part of my spiritual program, I pray to a higher power, whatever, and usually I pray in the shower. And at the time I was praying in the shower, and I felt really guilty about it because I felt like it was cheating. Mm. And this is something I never talk to anybody about because it's very private and personal.
Yeah.
And I would always pray in the shower and I'd be like, oh, like, sorry, whatever. Mm-hmm. I know that this is like killing two birds with one stone because I would get bored in the shower and like shaving my legs. And I would pray and that was what felt comfortable for me.
Yeah.
And it was just, I kept doing it and I kept feeling guilty about it.
Yeah.
And then she said, the last thing I'm going to say before I get off the phone is don't stop praying in the shower.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, tears, chills. Yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah.
And she was like, I don't know. I'm just getting that right now. There's something about your relationship with the water. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Pisces. Mm-hmm. But I didn't even say that. She was like, there's something about you and your relationship with water where it is like a safe place and it opens you up. And like, you feel like you're not doing it right. You are. Don't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the phone call, I didn't know if anything she had said was true or false because I was still going out with Machine by myself in the Lower East Side drinking water teenies. But like, I felt really happy.
Yeah.
I just, and I never had felt that after talking to a psychic.
Yeah.
So the next night I went by myself to see this band play that I had really liked. Mm-hmm. They were called the Soft Pack. They don't exist anymore, but I like them. They were playing right around the corner at the Mercury Lounge, and I thought the guys in the band were really cute.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I'm going to, and I knew the publicist. So I was like, I'm going to go and like totally like just introduce myself. And I know the publicist, she'll introduce me. And like, I love that band, whatever. And I had a crystal in my pocket because something that I'd also spoken about with the psychic was carrying a talisman with me that it would help ground me, like a coin or like a crystal or whatever. So I go see this band and I meet the guitarist and we're talking and we're like totally flirting and he's like, yeah, we're on tour, but when we're not, I live in LA. And I was like, oh, that's so funny because I spoke to a psychic yesterday and she told me I was gonna go out with a guy from LA. Well, I ended up going out with Maddie for a year back and forth between New York and LA. His mom worked at Delta. So I was able to get like really cheap flights and like standby all the time.
Yeah.
And I went out with Maddie for a year back and forth between New York and LA. We broke up when I started writing for Girls, which was an HBO show, which I started working for, like how I was telling you, my friend Nicole was like, you're going to do this. I thought she meant like, you know, in 20 years.
Yeah.
And it was just like, it was like a year and a half later.
Yeah.
Writing for TV, an HBO show. Started going out a little bit into Girls, started going out with the guy after the guy who I was not the one, who's now my husband. And I never stopped praying in the shower.
Yeah.
But I mean, isn't that cool?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. I mean, it's like because we never get that specific information from psychics, you know?
It was so specific and it was so without any agenda or planning on my part.
Yeah.
Like the next night, I met the guy that would take me to LA back and forth for a year, exactly what she said.
Yeah. It's really cool. I think that's really great. And it's like you got what you needed.
Yeah.
Just to pay attention. I think it's really cool. Sometimes it's like, let's just like look at this as like, I needed to pay attention. Like you needed to pay attention to the things that were happening around you for that material, like for that to put in motion.
totally. That's like a really, really good way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. You're right. And it is like, I didn't need to pay attention and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I think like also in it changing my life is that it's a great reminder mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. Like just pay attention and pay and like she was saying that too. She's like, pay attention to your lucky number when you see it. Like yeah. It's great. It's like,
yeah,
the universe is like giving you like a little like shout out. Like,
yeah. Which is that is like really being psychic, is really tuning in and listening to those small things. Like we have our interests, things that we like, the things mm-hmm. that we sort of favor for a reason. And yeah. that's part of it, you know, maybe to uncover your destiny.
I know, that's really nice.
It is.
Thanks for letting me share all of this.
Well, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com. Hi, this is Margaret Cho. You're listening to The Margaret Cho. Today, from The Onion, we have the incredible Scott Dickers. The 90s in Largo, I remember there was a guy, I think his name was John Schroeder, and he would walk around, and they were like, everybody would whisper, oh, he works at The Onion. And then it was like this thing, like The Onion. And we had not seen it yet. And I was a late adopter to the internet. But then we started to see The Onion, and it was in a very sort of like special place in comedians' hearts because it was so funny. And do you remember that person?
That's very kind of you to say. That is not a person that I know. So either
maybe the name didn't work. Wrong.
Yeah, you might just have the name wrong.
Yeah.
Because I knew everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and have for many years.
Yeah.
Especially if they were instrumental. But there are so many people who were a freelancer who sold one headline joke to The Onion who parlayed that into a sitcom writing career.
Yeah.
Countless people. So yeah. I don't know those people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, unless they were on staff or they were a regular contributor for a long time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know them.
I think that it was like, it was in the very beginning. I guess, when did it start?
88.
Wow.
Fall of 88 was the first issue.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was like, so it was a print publication?
Yep. It was a weekly college humor newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted it to be a magazine.
Yeah.
But we couldn't afford a magazine. So we
Glossy,
had to
yeah.
print it on newsprint in black and white. And it was very embarrassing and lame compared to Spy Magazine, which was the
Spy
gold standard of humor.
Of course,
at the time.
Spy Magazine. Jack Boulware, who is a San Francisco sort of like writer, musician guy.
He did pieces for them.
Yeah, he yeah, was.
It was the writing was so amazing and
yeah,
so good.
It was so good. Yeah,
I was just embarrassed. Those were my years of bombing. Was doing The Onion early.
Its first, was it like a zine?
4 or 5 years. No, it was a newspaper.
Yeah,
and so we kind of treated it like a magazine. Did a lot of wacky college humor, and occasionally we do like a fake news story, and it would be like, you know, supermarket tabloid parody type news story.
Because
mm-hmm. that's kind of what it looked like. It was tabloid sized and everything. And I realized that that was like the funniest stuff we were doing. And that was how we found our voice was, oh, we're a newspaper. We should be a newspaper parody. And we should use only this strict newspaper voice, this AP style.
Yeah.
And do all our humor through that lens. And mm-hmm. about 8 years in, we completely redesigned it and made it look much more like a major city daily newspaper
uh-huh.
than a college humor rag, and never broke that voice and always
right.
did everything. And unless it was an editorial or a fake ad or something, it was
yeah.
everything was in this world of this is a newspaper.
Yeah.
And if you picked it up and didn't know it was fake, it would look totally real and you'd be fooled until you started reading it. Then you'd realize, oh, this is completely ridiculous and
yeah.
made up.
Yeah. I love that though, because I think that the voice really is, it is genius. And I read this Reddit, it's called Ate the Onion, or
yeah, I know that, where they people who took it seriously, they who believe, should know better, yeah,
they just believe the story and then they're like outraged. Or there's also Not the Onion, which is stories that sound like they could be part of the Onion, but they're actually true.
There's another blog called Literally Unbelievable, which is a catalog of all the times where really important people like Congress people, world leaders, have taken Onion stories as fact.
Yes.
Yeah, which is so much fun.
That's really
fun. It's like a whole other layer of humor.
I mean, there's so many, great things, like, and it's always the funniest, all like the some of the things that are just like the minds of people that work on it. I mean, how did you find these writers in the beginning? I mean, were you writing like initially, like how was the process? Did you write it all yourself and then have people on later?
So there's a long and a short answer to that, but I did write a lot of it in the very beginning. I was just a cartoonist for the first like year or so. And I did three different cartoons under different pseudonyms and with different drawing styles. So it would look like they had this huge stable of cartoonists. Because that was the thing about local college newspapers. They always looked so lame because they had one cartoonist who could draw and do anything. So I wanted it to look very impressive in that way. And I occasionally would brainstorm ideas with the two guys who started it. But then they sold it to me, like after 1 year, they sold it to me and two other people, and I became the editor and co-owner. Then I was responsible for everything after that first year, even though I had only helped. And at first I wrote everything and I made the photos and I just did everything. And it was, you know, 14-hour days for a long, long time. And then where I found the people, it was very much like the formation of a band.
Yeah.
It was like, these weirdos would contact me and say, I love this. Can I write for you? And I'd say, what do you got? You know, show me something. And if I thought it was interesting, I'd bring them in and try them out. And some of them didn't work out, but the ones who worked out stayed. And they would say, hey, I know a guy who's kind of funny. Or, oh, we all know this guy who works at the grocery store who cracks up the customers, who's so funny. He used to be in the Arc Improv Theater where Chris Farley came from and Brian Stack came from. Joan Cusack, we're all in that troupe. And he's like this amazing comedic mind and he works in a grocery store. Let's bring him on in, you know? And so it was like collecting these people, some of whom knew each other, and developing this system for writing comedy as a group. Because we didn't know, we were in Madison, Wisconsin. We didn't know how you did that, how you did a writer's room or how you did any, you know, comedy professionally. I only knew from working with my friends in high school. We would do like skits and videos and movies and radio plays and stuff. And so we kind of cobbled together this system for trying to come up with the best material out of a group. It's really hard, like, because you kind of have to, whenever people get into a group, they act like chimpanzees. And whoever the alpha is going to get all their ideas in, regardless of whether they're funny or not.
Yeah.
So we came up with this merit-based system where any idea could be on the front page. If the cleaning lady had a good idea, it would go on the front page, you know? And so ideas, names were taken off of everything and everything was voted on by everyone and no one knew who wrote what. So you could say, oh, this idea is really good. This idea is really bad. And then you'd workshop the idea once you selected the headline. It always started with the headline.
Yeah.
And yeah, over time we just developed a really tight knit group and the staff didn't change over for like 15, 20 years. It was like the same staff.
Wow.
And then finally when The Onion moved to New York in 2001, it still didn't change over. All these people from Madison were just plucked out of Madison and dropped in New York. And then I left and came back in the mid-2000s and started bringing in some new blood. And we brought in all these like New York people who were different from the Midwestern people.
Yeah.
Very different. Ambitious. You know, people who had been interns on talk shows before. It was like, you know, oh, your dad's a preacher. Come on in, you know, like we didn't, there was no connection with the entertainment business or anything. It was just really smart people who were bitter and dropped out of college, many of them, and just had a lot to say. And but now we were getting like serious comedy people who wanted to. But all I was always very insistent on, I want people who have no experience because we did it very differently. And I just wanted people who were a blank slate, who I could teach like how we do a comedy at The Onion. And so that was really rewarding. And, you know, there's still a culture, like the staff changes over more now. And I haven't been there for a few years, but the culture is still very much intact.
Yeah.
Where it's this bubble of people who are all have a similar mindset.
Yeah.
That's kind of like the collective onion voice.
Yeah. But it still hasn't, the essential like message of it or the feeling hasn't changed, because it is like these news stories that it's like, they're just so perfect. And it's not,
I appreciate you saying that,
but it seems like it's like one person that's like,
right.
The style of it is like one person.
Yeah. And that was very intentional.
Yeah.
I wanted the celebrity to be the onion.
Yeah.
Because I had seen so many other comedy publications fail that made the writers into celebrities.
Right.
Like at the Lampoon, when Doug Kinney, and when John Hughes left, people were like, oh, it's not going to be funny anymore. And I'm going to follow this celebrity writer as they make movies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want that to happen. Same with Spy. Somebody bought Spy and Kurt Anderson and Graydon Carter left, and it was like, oh, it's not funny anymore.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be so if people took a job on a TV show, nobody would know, because it would still look like The Onion. It would still have the same thing. The bylines right. wouldn't change. We would always mix up the names in the staff box.
Uh-huh.
So nobody knew who did what, who was in charge,
yeah.
you know? And so that made, I think that's really helped The Onion survive as a brand
yeah.
where a lot of comedy publications just haven't survived that long. Mad yeah. Magazine is the only one that's close. Cracked, I guess, but they've really evolved into a different thing.
Yeah, Cracked has kind of become
clickbait, kind of.
Yeah, it's different. It was just, it's not like with Mad Magazine, Mad Magazine is also, to me, is very rooted in the 60s. Like, it's very still like Alfred E. Newman, kind of like
yeah.
Spy versus Spy.
Like countercultural parody. It has that vibe.
Yeah, yeah. But there's something about it that's still kind of old fashioned.
Yeah.
I think Cracked is like more modern. I don't know. But The Onion is, it's like the brilliance of it hasn't changed, you know, it hasn't shifted. And I think it's because it's like, we're always going to appreciate that kind of like dry news feel.
I think so. I mean, there's so many imitators. It's hard to differentiate now because so many people are doing that,
mm-hmm.
but it's makes me happy to hear you say that. Cause again, that was the intent, that cause I look at it and I see waxing and waning in quality, you know, cause I'm so close to it, but to the outside world, I think it takes a long time for a publication to suck before people start noticing.
Well, it's like you almost, but every time it's like, well, anything like there's like a big world event, you can't wait for The Onion's take on it.
Yeah. There's always that, like, we're never going to run out of world events. Like
yeah.
those are always going to be happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
are there,
it seems fresh.
Are there favorites that you have over the years? Like, was there some things that you just really remember as being your favorite?
Oh yeah. So many. One of my favorites was when George W. Bush won the Supreme Court case and was appointed president mm-hmm. by the Supreme Court. We held off, like, we didn't publish a lot because it was like 2 months between the election and when they knew who won,
mm-hmm.
between Bush and Gore. And the headline was a picture of Bush in front of a flag, and the big headline was Bush : quote, our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity is finally over. And the whole article, which was written by this guy who worked in a grocery store and mm-hmm. was cracking up customers, who became our head writer, is a very funny guy named Todd Hansen. The article basically spelled out what George W. Bush was going to do over the next 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to find a country to invade and invade it. And
yeah.
he didn't care that it didn't do anything mm-hmm. to us and waste a ton of money. He was going to tank the economy and just basically foretold the next 8 years very plainly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it now, it reads like a history book, like Nostradamus.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it was such, and like, that's not that hard. Like, if you did some research and saw what his policies were, you knew what he was going to do.
Right.
So, but people look at that who maybe don't think of it that hard, and they're like, oh my God, you guys predicted the future. But it feels kind of cool. I like when The
yeah.
Onion does things that predict the future, because it just makes us look really smart.
Yeah.
And really, sometimes all it takes is a little Wikipedia research and you can know enough.
Yeah.
Another similar story to that, which I love. The headline wasn't that funny, but the story is one of my favorites. It was an editorial by the CEO of the Gillette Razor Company.
Mm-hmm.
And the headline was, fuck it, we're doing five blades. And the story is so funny because he's so cocky.
Yeah.
About how, you know, the competition's going 4 blades in an Alice trip. Fuck them. We're not going to get caught with our pants down. We're putting in 5 blades, 2 on the side, you know, and all this stuff. And lo and behold, a few months later, Gillette introduces 5-bladed
razors.
Yeah,
that's
it was like
great.
Amazing that you think you're being hyperbolic.
Right.
And then the world says, I can top that.
It's great.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful.
It's really great.
Because that's the gold standard. Real life is always, in my opinion, going to be funnier than anything you can make up.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you can make up something that it's really funny and people love, and then it happens in real life, and mm-hmm. it's funny in real life, you know you've kind of hit the gold standard of comedy.
It is, yeah, it's true. I always wonder, did you guys ever think about like doing like a CNN, like a channel, like a 24-hour news channel?
Yeah, so in the mid-2000s we started doing web video because Ooh. The bandwidth was at to the point where people could download videos,
yeah,
reasonably, and other news networks were putting clips of their news online. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, well, this is perfect for us. We'll do parodies of those.
Yeah.
And so we started this thing called ONN, Onion News Network, which was a pretend global CNN type network that had all these channels. We had Headline News. We had like Family Channel. We had all this fake, these channels. And we were just showing clips online.
Uh-huh.
And we spent so much money on those. We'd spend $25,000 on a 3-minute video mm-hmm. to make it look like a real news network.
Yeah, yeah.
And those were really, like, people told us, why are you doing this? Because mm-hmm. The Daily Show kind of has fake news handled on TV.
Yeah.
And then Colbert came out and they're like, look, he's doing it fine. Mm-hmm. Like, why? uh-huh. You can't do any better than that. But we had a different idea. We wanted to make it seem real,
mm-hmm.
so people would see it and think it was a real news network. But again, the subjects were insane.
Yeah.
So we had this thing called O-SPAN, which was a parody of C-SPAN.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have Congress, and you'd see a guy giving a speech. And there's a congressman giving a speech about the anti-ocular penetration bill, which was the anti-skull fucking bill.
Uh-huh.
And so he's saying, we have to stop these young people from fucking skulls, you know? And it's just bizarre and funny and weird. And it's played so straight. So mm-hmm. if you catch it, you're like, what, did this happen?
Yeah.
What? And all this. And then the news segments, which were like CNN, same thing. We do these crazy stories like Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell and KFC, introduces the feed bag, and it's just uh-huh. this sack, like this horse sack that goes over your face, and all the food is mashed into it, and you mm-hmm. can just walk throughout your day and just mash the food into your mouth
mm-hmm.
So you don't have to bother picking up your food and eating it. So it's like perfect for the American consumer.
Yeah.
And it just looked so real and mm-hmm. so believable. That was so much fun. And those won a Peabody, those videos.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it was so surprising. Like, we used to make jokes about The Onion winning prestigious journalism awards.
Yeah.
And then it happened.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
That's awesome.
I know.
I think that's really great.
It's so bizarre.
I think, that's the essence of what's so funny about all of the Onion stories, is because it is like played so straight and dry that people can't help but you just laugh because it's like so serious.
People forget how important the straight man is, to use a gender non-neutral term, is in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're always just wacky and silly, it's really tiring. You need that straight contrast for it to work.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, like when there were comedy duos, a wacky person like Gracie Allen and a straight man like George Burns,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't her wacky line that got the laugh. It was his reaction that got the laugh. So
right.
if you're, and also it's, I think it's goes even deeper than that. It's almost like the same way a child likes a game of peekaboo.
Mm-hmm.
They like to know that there's somebody hiding behind something. Like, people love that.
Mm-hmm.
To see something and know there's an intelligence behind it that's pretending not to be there.
Yeah.
So we're acting all straight and important, but really we're these snickering troublemakers mm-hmm. behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Like, putting on this show. Like, people love that.
Yeah.
It's a facade. It's like, it's an added layer.
Mm-hmm.
So much humor now is, especially online, is all like snarky, on the nose, observational humor where people are just talking about their lives
mm-hmm.
and there's no facade.
Right.
And I learned a lot from Mark Twain with that, because he was a brilliant satirist and mm-hmm. wrote super funny books. And Huck Finn, for example, is written in the voice of Huck Finn. So he mm-hmm. plays a 13-year-old character writing the book.
Yeah.
And it just makes it so much more interesting when you have this very believable 13-year-old telling you the story. but you know there's this wisdom behind it.
Mm-hmm.
The machinator behind the curtain, like we were talking about before, pulling the strings and leading you on this journey.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel so comfortable that, okay, this is a master storyteller.
Yeah.
He's going to take me somewhere. Awesome. I trust him.
Right.
And they want that. And mm-hmm. if they don't sense it, it just feels very plain.
Mm-hmm.
So I love those layers. There's so many layers to the onion. We used to say any story in the onion is going to be 5 times funnier than any story in any other publication, even if it's not as funny, because right. of the context.
Yeah.
It's in the context of a fake newspaper, so you already have this built-in straight man,
mm-hmm.
and then it uses this character archetype mm-hmm. from Commedia dell'arte, the braggart captain, which is like mm-hmm. the bumbling authority.
Yes.
This is someone who's very important, but they're saying things that are completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like Ron Burgundy.
Right.
So that's another layer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you usually have irony because the thing you're talking about in the story is something really small and stupid and unimportant.
Yeah.
But it's presented as this very important thing.
Right.
So you already have like 3 very powerful literary tools of humor at work before you've written word one of the story.
Which is great.
Yeah. So, maybe that's more more than you bargained for in terms of the straight news voice, but that's kind of where all that came from.
I mean, because there's so much that goes into it. Now, do you have like stories where it becomes like whatever Donald Trump says is fake news, like that they like stories that like people have used like Donald Trump maybe as like being true that are from the Onion?
Yeah. So I have really mixed feelings about that whole fake news thing because I remember when The Daily Show first used that term
mm-hmm.
in an ad in the New York Times, I think, for their show.
Mm-hmm.
The leader in fake news or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of all cringed. We were like, ooh, you don't want to like wink at the audience like that and tell them it's fake. It's better to say, this is very serious, important news.
Yes.
But they're a different beast, you know. Yeah. And Ben Carlin, who worked for us at The Onion for a long time, went and, you know, kind of molded that show with Jon Stewart mm-hmm. and created the Colbert Show with Stephen. They're dealing with a different animal and Jon Stewart smirks at the audience, so they can afford to do that a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was kind of, for us at The Onion, it was like, ooh, they're crossing a line. Like on our ONN videos, we would never do that.
Yeah.
We made The Onion News Network seem like this global leader in news, news that will terrify you. You know, and so it had to be played totally straight.
Yeah.
Wacky, but played straight.
Yeah.
And so then in the 2016 election, when these fake news outlets were putting out just lies, like propaganda
right.
disguised as news,
mm-hmm.
that's how Trump was able to like, you know, start labeling news he didn't like as fake news, because there was this real phenomena of propaganda
mm-hmm.
masquerading as satire. And these people didn't understand what satire was.
Right.
Because they were labeling their fake news propaganda satire.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is that The Onion was like one of the only publications doing satire for like 20 years.
Yeah.
Spy was gone.
Mm-hmm.
People forgot that the Greeks did satire in ancient Greece. And they don't think of things like The Simpsons as satire.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of like literary satire, it just doesn't hit the mainstream. So many people can conflate fake news with satire.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if you want to do satire, you have to do AP style and talk about current events.
Yes.
That's not a thing.
Yes.
That's just what The Onion does.
Yes.
But people literally, like young people who grew up on The Onion, think that's what satire is.
Mm-hmm.
So people labeled their fake news satire
mm-hmm.
because they didn't understand what satire was. And then Trump could extrapolate that and call news he didn't like fake news. And then The Onion got tarred for like, aren't you confusing people by putting out things that aren't real?
Yeah.
And, you know, contributing to this misinformation problem that we have in society.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, technically The Onion is partly at fault for that. But it's the audience's fault for like not doing their research. Like if you read The Onion and have half a brain,
you know it's a joke. Fake. Like you know it's fake.
You have to. And if you're producing news parody that's so subtle that people can't tell if it's real or fake or made up
mm-hmm.
or supposed to be hilarious or real, that's on you. Or it's on the creator if they're not making it funny enough for people to get.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what that stuff was. It was just propaganda. It wasn't even funny.
Yeah.
And then you're just like punking people, but for what? Like,
yeah,
I'm happy to punk people if it's really funny.
Yeah.
And they take it seriously and we all get a second laugh.
Yeah.
From them getting punked.
Yeah.
But then at the end, everybody laughs and says, ah, you got me. That was a good one. And that's how that has to end.
I think that's exactly right. I think that there's also, there's certain characters throughout time that I think The Onion has done really well with. I think, well, Trump would be one, of course, but I always love anything about Ben Carson. There's something about Ben Carson that
he's a fascinating character.
He was a very fascinating character and a really good Onion stories about him because he was so dumb, but he was also brain surgeon.
Yeah.
Like,
great built-in irony.
So much about him. Like, there was just, you know, that I think was like somebody that I wish was more in the news because you could do more with him.
Yeah. Well, thankfully the world, is never wanting for stupid people stupid things.
That's really true. And so like now you still go back and like oversee or you're just not?
I'm not involved.
Not involved.
Yeah. So I left and started this program at the Second City or in partnership with the Second City in Chicago and in partnership with The Onion to train people how to write satire.
Mm-hmm.
And in line with what I was saying before, it's not how to write fake news. It's how to write satire. So it's more foundational. But a lot of people have come out of those classes and gotten jobs at The Onion and Clickhole. And so I've been tangentially involved in that way, like training people how to do it. And now I don't do that anymore. I started this website, howtowritefunny.com, where I teach people how to write comedy with books and courses and stuff. Because doing The Onion for so long, I developed a system that I think really works.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taught it to people and they've made it work for themselves and gotten good jobs for it. And so now, you know, we're probably a similar age.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at that age where it's like, I don't want to be part of that 12-hour a day grind, you know, producing comedy on deadline. That's so rough.
It's rough, yeah.
I did it all throughout my 20s, 30s, and 40s. Like, that's, I'm fine.
Yeah.
So now I just get to be like the professor emeritus of comedy.
Which is great.
Which is very fulfilling and wonderful.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's what I'm doing now.
Well, you certainly figured out the equation. I mean, it is like a mathematical equation.
It is, yeah.
You know? There is like it's like physics and a geometry. There's a geometry to it.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, I think it's comforting actually, because people think of it as like such a mystery, but it's actually we can work this out.
Yeah. And I love how it attracts geniuses. And I am not one of those people. In the Onion Writers meeting, I was always the dumbest person in the room because there were people who had like genius level IQs, who aced their SATs, like these sorts of people for whom joke writing was like a mathematical problem.
Mm-hmm.
How can you make the funniest thing with the fewest possible words?
Yes.
And it was a puzzle to them.
Yeah.
And every day they're trying to come up with these haiku headlines. Mm-hmm. Like one of our guys came up with this headline. He was like one of these Harvard geniuses and he came up with a 3-word palindrome headline for our book, Artem Century, which looks back at the 20th century through fake front pages of The Onion. For when Jerry Garcia died. And the headline was Head, Dead, Head, Dead. And it's like, how brilliant is that?
So genius.
It's like perfect.
Yeah, it's great. Well, I think you are a genius.
Oh, even though that's too kind of you.
No, but I think you are. And thank you for bringing The Onion to the world. And thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for coming here and talking to me.
It has been my
today.
Pleasure. It was a lot of work, but it was also a pleasure.
I love it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Never miss an episode of The Margaret Show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Margaret Show is an Erios production with editing by Kat Hong and original music by Garrison Starr.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.